From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The election that could define the future of France and Europe is less than a week away. And the two candidates, far-right leader Marine Le Pen and centrist Emmanuel Macron, held campaign rallies today coinciding with May Day labor marches. Five major unions are urging their members not to vote for Le Pen, but only two unions have expressed support for Macron. Here's Marine Le Pen speaking to her supporters today.
Alors, je vous épargnerai les journalistes, nous y passerions la nuit, mais...
Let's bring in NPR's Eleanor Beardsley in Paris. Eleanor, we do hear enthusiasm for Le Pen.
Oh, Robin, you can't imagine. You just heard her there with her supporters. You know, they are hanging on every word she says. They boo, they applaud at all the right times. She was talking there about Emmanuel Macron, her opponent, about all of his billionaire friends. And, you know, Robin, she's portraying him in two ways. One, as a continuation of unpopular President François Hollande, and as a total elite out of touch with the people, a former banker who's never even held elective office. So that's how she is portraying her opponent. And, you know, Robin, I spoke to one Le Pen supporter after the rally, 20-year-old Jean-Philippe Chalopin, and he says it's not just about the economy, it's about French pride.
She offers hope for us. I mean, she will allow the economy to be more French-friendly and not have all our businesses go abroad to seek lower wages. And also hope, I mean, pride. Pride, I mean, not only economics, pride in who we are as a people. We've been told for years, you know, to shut up, and it has been going on for so many years, and we're so tired of it. There's no way we're going to bow to the elites any longer.
Well, but what about her? Russ Douthat, the conservative columnist in the New York Times, writes that she actually has some important policy ideas. You say that she's a terrific speaker, but it's her party that people are concerned about. It was racist, anti-Semitic under her father. Has she moved away from that, or has she just traded anti-Semitic for anti-immigrant?
Yeah, it's a good question, Robin. I mean, analysts say that she has moved away, and I've been to her rallies as opposed to rallies like 7 years ago, and the people are different. They're not just, you know, unemployed, angry, blue-collar workers. She's got professionals. And she now portrays herself. She's broken with her father. He was out this morning. She does not appear with him. He was the one who had the, you know, xenophobic, anti-Semitic tirades. She's another generation. She's attracted women. She's attracted young people. And she's now the protector of the people against the ravages of globalization, against French companies moving to Poland for lower wages, against all those things that can hurt you. And so she characterizes herself now as the person who's going to protect the little guy. She's the champion of the people.
Well, Macron told the BBC today that he is pro-Europe and the European Union, but he also said the European Union has to reform or face the prospect of Frexit. This is France leaving the EU the way Britain is scheduled to. Here he is.
I'm a pro-European. I defended constantly during this election the European idea and European policies and so on, because I do believe it's extremely important for French people and for the place of our country in globalization. The question is that you have almost half of this country angry with the European idea. So we have to reform this Europe. We need a new European Union in situation to protect our people and to regulate our globalization.
Eleanor, is that going to be enough to overcome Le Pen's accusations about him?
Well, Robin, I think he is being dragged into this protectionist debate. Marine Le Pen is very protectionist. Her policies are very much like the far left candidates, protecting people. He is now having to say, because he's known as an economic liberal, which means very free market, very capitalist, and people are saying he's just going to let capitalism destroy France and jobs. So he's having to talk about protections now. But his plans are actually to make France more open, more innovative. He says, I cannot guarantee that I will save your obsolete job, but I'll train you for a new job for the 21st century. But Robin, these are complex ideas that are harder to get across than, for example, saying, you know, I'm going to get out of the European Union and that's going to solve all of our problems.
Well, but who's going to come out this Sunday? We see that Macron is 20 percentage points ahead of Marine Le Pen. But then we're reading reports of people who you'd think would vote for him and perhaps vote against her, not motivated to come out.
That's right, Robin. A lot of people are not excited by him. You know, he's young and he's got new plans and he doesn't belong to any party. But on the flip side of that is he has no experience. He's never run for public office. And people say he can just talk and basically say nothing. They say he's an empty shell. Her supporters will come out. They're sure to come out. His supporters, half of them support him and half of them are just voting against her. So that's the group that may not come out. And we've seen something in this election we didn't see the last time when her father made it to the second round in 2002. We had something like a united front against him. We haven't seen that so much this time. A lot of people are saying neither nor. I don't want Le Pen, but I don't want Macron either. And so they might vote blank or they might not come at all. And that could make it a lot closer than polls show.
NPR's Eleanor Beardsley ahead of next Sunday's election in France. Eleanor, thanks as always.
Thank you, guys.
Well, lots going on this week in Washington. It appears the government will not shut down after a deal was reached to keep it funded through September. We're also waiting to see what happens with health care. The White House says it has the votes in the House for a health care overhaul. Meanwhile, the White House has launched a review of 24 national monuments created since 1996. And the stage is set now for fighting over the Antiquities Act. That's the federal law that allows presidents to make those designations. And over the future of the newest monument, an expanse in southeastern Utah surrounding the twin mesas of Bear's Ears. Judy Faze from KUER in Salt Lake City reports.
Sally Jewell was President Obama's Interior Secretary when she presided over a listening session last summer in the picturesque town of Bluff. Southeastern Utah's Red Rock Country was over 100 degrees that day, but hundreds stayed for a debate over the future of nearby land that everyone cherishes. Johnny Slavens was born and raised in the nearby town of Blanding. He questioned the government's role in public lands.
Madam Secretary, can you please answer to us what gives you the constitutional right to come in here and dictate land in the state of Utah?
Ethel Branch is the Attorney General for the Navajo Nation. She urged federal action.
Making this designation will take courage, and I pray that the president has the courage to make this designation.
Jewel was wrapping up as afternoon faded.
I have heard you loud and clear.
Ryan Zinke is the new Interior Secretary, and at a signing ceremony last week, President Trump directed him to reassess national monuments. Topping the list, Bear's Ears, created by President Obama late last year.
Mr. President, thank you once again for fulfilling your campaign promise to give a voice to our local communities and states.
Trump's executive order gives Zinke the summer for suggesting changes to the monuments and possibly the century-old Antiquities Act. Utah Republicans and the Trump administration say reform is long overdue.
Trump administration is doing what should have been done in the first place. They're not only talking to people who live on the ground, but actually listening to them.
Congressman Rob Bishop is chairman of the House Resources Committee, and he's ready to help the administration with the overhaul. He represents the concern of many Utah locals who've traditionally mined and ranched federal public lands.
Ultimately, there has to be some kind of legislative changes that are made.
A president has never rescinded another president's monument, says Attorney John Leshy.
Recommendations could include going to Congress, trying to take action on his own, or doing nothing. And at this point, leaves all options open.
Leshy was the Interior Department's top lawyer 2 decades ago when President Bill Clinton created another controversial monument in Utah, the Grand Staircase Escalante. He says the Antiquities Act has survived past challenges.
I think the defenders hopefully will make themselves heard loud and clear in this process and say we're fine and happy with these things and don't tinker with them.
And what's crazy is antiquities, right? Who's more antique than Native American tribes?
Sean Chapuis is chairman of the Ute Tribe, part of the Bears Ears Intertribal Coalition. It was at the coalition's request that Obama designated 1.3 million acres around Bears Ears, protecting thousands of archaeological sites, sacred tribal traditions, and livestock grazing.
Really what we're trying to protect by designating the area is exactly the history of the first peoples here in North America.
Chapuis points out that Bears Ears is the only one of 150 monuments in which Native American tribes will have a co-management role. Rock climbers, archaeologists, conservationists, and even local entrepreneurs want the monument to stick. They say the area has more potential value for recreation than mining. Ashley Kornblatt runs a cycling guide service in Moab, a tourist town that used to be a mining hub north of the monument area.
The Antiquities Act is bringing economic development to places where resource extraction hasn't been providing.
The outdoor recreation industry, she points out, reports $887 billion in annual consumer spending.
The folks that are asking for this review hope to prove that we're hurting the economy of these communities. But the reality is we are promoting those economies because in the 21st century, people want to visit historic and natural places, which is what the Antiquities Act provides.
The Trump administration directive doesn't require Zinke to get broad public input for his review, but the Interior Secretary is promising to visit Utah, just like his predecessor did last summer. For Here and Now, I'm Judy Fays in Salt Lake City.
And Judy's story comes to us from Inside Energy, a public media collaboration focusing on America's energy issues. In San Francisco, workers are finally beginning the process of installing a suicide prevention barrier on the Golden Gate Bridge. The bridge is tall and publicly accessible with a pedestrian walkway and a railing that is easy to hop over. That has made it a popular destination for suicide. Since the bridge was built in 1933, an estimated 1,700 bodies have been pulled from the water below. And while thousands have been talked down, fewer than 30 people have been known to survive the fall. From Here Now contributor KQED, Jessica Plachek reports on the new prevention barrier.
Today marks the beginning of the end of suicides on the Golden Gate Bridge.
Kimberly Renee Gamboa lost her 18-year-old son when he jumped off the bridge 4 years ago. She spoke at a ceremony commemorating the start of work on the barrier.
Soon, no family will experience the devastation and tragedy of a suicide on the Golden Gate Bridge. Thank you.
Advocacy from friends and family of those who've jumped are part of why the barrier is being put up.
The suicide deterrent system, or NET as it's commonly referred to, is a hard mesh stainless steel platform.
This is Priya David Clemens, a spokesperson for the Golden Gate Bridge Highway and Transportation District.
So it's 20 feet down from the sidewalk, and it extends out 20 feet over the ocean.
Clemens says the steel won't be visible from afar, and views from the bridge will be unchanged. But
if someone jumps or falls into it, they're going to break a bone, they're going to bruise themselves.
But they're not likely to die, and Clemens says that's the point.
People come to the bridge thinking they're going to have a painless death. It is not a painless death.
When someone jumps off the Golden Gate Bridge, they'll usually hit the water at around 75 miles per hour, often suffering from blunt force trauma before they drown.
It's a horrible death.
Bridge Captain Lisa Licati oversees a patrol team that helped talk down 184 potential jumpers last year.
Some officers actually take people off the sidewalk two or three times in their shift, different people. And so it does weigh on people. We have a very close-knit group.
So why did it take so long to build something that could save so many lives? Eve Meyer is executive director of San Francisco Suicide Prevention.
Our agency has been fighting for a deterrent for close to 50 years.
Meyer says the net was only approved after officials were assured the bridge wouldn't look different. She also attributes it to the fact that public opinion on suicide has shifted.
We have had an attitude that somehow these people deserved to die.
Another obstacle to getting a barrier, skeptics wondered why $211 million should be spent on the Golden Gate Bridge net, thinking if people couldn't kill themselves there, they'd just do it somewhere else.
There was a study at the University of California that showed that they didn't, that 10 years later, people who had been taken off the bridge were still alive or had died of natural causes. People who came to the bridge at night when the doors were closed did not run out into traffic and kill themselves by having a car hit them. They went home.
This month, a temporary barrier will go up to protect workers taking measurements below the walkways. The project is expected to be completed in 2021. For Here and Now, I'm Jessica Plachek in San Francisco.
Well, Kevin Hines is one of the few people to have survived a suicide leap from the Golden Gate Bridge. He was 19 when he tried to kill himself back in 2000. He was struggling with mental illness at the time. In 2014, I spoke with Kevin and I asked him to take us back to the day he made the decision to jump off the bridge.
Well, you know, I always tell people that it wasn't as much of a cognitive decision as it was that I was compelled to jump off the bridge by the terrible hallucinations and voices in my head. I have a severe form of bipolar disorder that leads me to have hallucinations, both auditory and visual. And on a particular day, I was hearing voices saying that I had to die, that I had no other option, that I was a burden to all that I loved. and that I was useless. And there I was on that bridge, wanting and wishing and praying for someone to come up to me and ask me if I was okay, because all I could think of was death, and the voices in my head were telling me that I had to die. So it was because of bipolar disorder, it was because of mental illness, and it was because my brain, my brain's chemicals were imbalanced, and it really had nothing to do with any kind of situational problem. It was solely based on my mental illness.
And we read that the moment your hands left the rails, you knew it was a mistake.
Absolutely. When people attempt suicide, quite often they're shocked into reality. And in that case, that happened to me. I was in free fall, and it was instant regret. What have I just done? I don't want to die. God, please save me. I made a mistake. And then I hit the water. It was the worst action I'd ever taken, and it almost ended up in my early demise.
But you didn't die from that. What happened when you hit the water?
Well, to be blunt, I shattered my T12, L1, and L2 lower vertebrae into shards like glass that splintered throughout my lower abdomen behind the muscle, lacerating some organs. They really just popped and splintered everywhere. I went down about 70 to 80 feet, but then I opened my eyes and I thought, what the heck? You know, I thought I was hallucinating this entire event. I thought I couldn't have just done that. That didn't just happen. And I wouldn't be alive. So of course it didn't just happen. But then when I finally resurfaced, after initially going down, and after, nearly passing out and drowning, I broke the surface and I bobbed up and down in the water, and I simply prayed, God, please save me. I don't want to die. I made a mistake. As I bobbed up and down in the water, swallowing some salt water and trying to stay afloat, only using my arms because my legs were completely immobile, something brushed by my legs, and I thought, you've got to be kidding me. I thought, this is ridiculous. I didn't die off that bridge, and now a shark's going to devour me. Well, it turns out it was not a shark. It was, in fact, a sea lion. And the people above looking down, who were on the bridge, believed it to be keeping me afloat until the Coast Guard boat arrived behind me. All over the world, dolphins and sea lions have been recorded to do these kinds of things. I found out years later that from a man who happened to be right next to me, 2 feet away from me when I jumped, he was the one that told me after I made a comment on the news that I thought there was a shark beneath me, that it was no shark and that it was, in fact, a sea lion.
Mm. Wow.
From that point, the Coast Guard boat arrived within the timeline where I would not set into hypothermia, or prior to that anyway. And I know that because a woman who was driving by saw me jump, had a friend in the Coast Guard, and called that friend immediately. And that is the reason they arrived to me within less than 12 minutes before I would set into hypothermia and drown. From that point on, the third part of what I call the miracle is that I got to the hospital. And one of the foremost back surgeons this side of the West Coast was there, and he was supposed to be gone the day prior, but for whatever reason he had stayed, and he opted to do my surgery, which replaced my 3 vertebrae with titanium, allowing me the ability to walk.
Kevin, why did you decide to jump off the Golden Gate Bridge, though? Why was it the Golden Gate Bridge that you went to commit suicide?
Well, like I said, it wasn't a cognitive decision, but the reason I went there was because I had seen a website by accident the night prior as I searched for a method. And sadly, there are websites out there that promote suicide, and they're made by, in my opinion, evil people. They're websites that say whoever you are, wherever you are in your life and whatever you're doing, that you should die just because. That's what they're big proponents of. And on this website, it said if you go to San Francisco and you go to the Golden Gate Bridge and you jump off, you will die upon impact. Good luck! Exclamation point. And for me, as sick as I was, that was a calling card. And it mentioned about the height of the rail, and it would just be easy and as they describe, painless. And that's the furthest from the truth. There are tens of ways to die off the Golden Gate Bridge, none of which are painless. They're all terribly violent, slow deaths. And so it was these lies that were perpetuated in my psychotic mind that brought me specifically to that point. Had there been a net or railing at the Golden Gate Bridge, you see, I had no money. I only had money to get on the bus to get to the bridge. I had no money and I had no cell phone. Had there been a net or a rail, I would have been stopped immediately, and I would have been cornered, and I would have been taken to mental health care because I would have had to break down right there within my my mental pain.
A net would have stopped you from jumping, or a net would have caught you after you jumped?
It would have stopped me from jumping because I would have realized what it was. It would have given me much more time, and I was already acting erratically at the bridge, you know, crying and wailing profusely. I would have been noticed, and it would have stopped me.
Do you ever go back to the bridge?
I did, actually. I went back with my father the year after the attempt, and we're driving. He said, "Kevin, we're going to take a drive," and I saw where we were going, and I said, "Dad, what are you doing?" He goes, "Well, we got to find some closure, Kev," and we stopped by there was a flower bed on the way, and he said, "Pick a flower." So I picked a flower from a flower bed. And we got on the car, went all the way out to the Golden Gate Bridge parking lot. We parked, and he walked with me to exactly where I jumped, and we said a prayer, and we dropped the flower. The flower hit the water, and 2 feet to the right popped up a sea lion. So I know I'm supposed to be here, and I know there's a reason why. I guess I'll just be finding that reason out as life goes on.
Well, we're glad you're still here. Kevin, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
It's Kevin Hines speaking with us in 2014 about his jump off the Golden Gate Bridge. We have this update. Kevin continues to manage his mental illness. He's become an advocate for mental health issues and suicide prevention. And Kevin is currently working on a film, Suicide, The Ripple Effect. You can find out more at hereandnow.org. 21st Century Fox could soon be the owner of 42 new television stations. The company is reportedly in talks to bid on Tribune Media, which is a separate company from the print division that owns the Chicago Tribune and the LA Times. The Sinclair Broadcast Group has also made an offer on Tribune Media. Joining us for more is NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik. Hi, David.
Hey, Jeremy.
And tell us more about these potential bidders for Tribune Media, 21st Century Fox and Sinclair Broadcast Group. What do each of them have to gain from buying up more stations?
Well, buying up more stations means you can, you know, certainly in some ways cut backroom costs and try to make more money. Stations have been heretofore, you know, a pretty good way to print cash. You know, there's some pressures on the business, but nonetheless, it's a profitable one. And it also allows the Murdochs to have more control of their own destiny. There are a lot of Fox affiliates in there. Obviously, the owners of Fox affiliates get to negotiate contracts with Murdoch's company to carry his programs. If Sinclair, which has an astonishing number of local stations across the country, over 100, 150, and has a bunch of Fox stations, were to add these to their portfolio, they'd have an even stronger hand in negotiating things with the Murdochs. So in some ways, this is an offensive move by the Murdochs to grow, and in some ways, it's a defensive move to protect its territory against Sinclair, which is a powerful force in its own right.
Are there concerns about consolidation in the industry with either of these buyers?
Well, not if you listen to Fox, not if you listen to Sinclair. But sure, there are a lot of consumer advocates who say, look, you're seeing a lot of sameness around the country, and you're also seeing a lot of consolidation. And this would only, in either case, accentuate that. For those who say, oh, my goodness, I hope it's Sinclair if they don't like conservatives and they don't like the Murdochs, or I hope it isn't Sinclair because I do like conservatives, I do like the Murdochs. The Sinclair Broadcast ownership, the Smith brothers, who I used to cover when I was a reporter in Baltimore Sun, are, if anything, more conservative than Rupert Murdoch and have had planted that stamp on their national political coverage that is seen in a lot of their stations around the country. So that's an interesting little wrinkle in there as well.
Now, the Murdochs are trying in the UK to take full control of Sky, and we've heard all about how they have to be deemed by the regulator fit and proper. What about in this country? Is there any concern based on all of the allegations against Fox News, the lawsuits against Fox News, that could stop a deal for Murdoch and 21st Century Fox to buy even more?
You know, there's something somewhat related in terms of how the FCC evaluates each individual local television license and who it's held by. So in each case, people could challenge the Murdoch's control of local stations in front of the FCC when they come up. I've got to say we appear to be entering a fairly deregulatory era when it comes to the FCC and when it comes to the communications business. And I think that if anything, they're looking to lift inhibitions from people to be able to snap up more stations. I think that the Murdochs, you know, in the past, past, there's been this question of cross-ownership. The same company or family can't control major newspapers and major stations, too many of them in the same market. Their bid for Tribune suggests they think they're going to get away with that in Los Angeles as they have a number of stations there, but also have an interest in taking an eye at the LA Times. As you pointed out in your introduction, technically a separate company at Tribune. Technically, those are held – the newspapers are held by a separate Murdoch enterprise,
right,
at News Corp. But actually, the way the law has previously been interpreted, it's really the common ownership. I think you're going to see deregulation in that regard as well.
That separate company, by the way, we're reminded, is called Trunk. It got a lot of heat for that name, so I'm glad we're able to say it once again.
Well deserved.
David Folkenflik, NPR media correspondent, thank you.
You bet.
Have you ever changed your mind about one of those really big issues? In a recent online Ask Reddit forum, users were asked, former climate change deniers, what changed your mind? Karen Kirk is a freelance journalist who took a look at the answers for the news site Yale Climate Connections. She joins us by Skype. What did you find?
I think the most startling thing right off the bat is that, holy cow, people can still change their minds.
Yes.
It's like we are only going in the opposite direction right now. They were digging deeper and deeper and deeper and getting more and more defensive about our stances. And so it was kind of astonishing.
What did they say about why they were holding on to climate change denial?
The most common sort of origin story of where their denial came from and why it was deep within them is that it came from their family. Mm-hmm. So they were raised by parents who didn't believe it. They described, you know, my parents are yelling at the TV anytime it's mentioned, or they described, I'm just... You know, we dismiss science. That's what we do. And so it was sort of part of people's upbringing.
So family, social environment, a big reason. Someone wrote, I denied it through middle school, mostly because my family rigorously shot it down.
Yeah.
Another wrote, my dad told me it wasn't real. Well, in a report from Yale University, researchers found that as social beings, humans do adapt to group norms. You know, in order to be part of the family and have meals, you know, you tend to agree with people in the family. But what is powerful enough to overcome that? Why did they change?
I'm super happy to share the number one reason why people changed, and it's science. People were just understanding the scientific basis. Greenhouse effect and the human fingerprint on climate change is not that hard to understand, and people were just like, yeah, I get it. I CO2. We're adding CO2. One person wrote about how they saw a graph of temperature and CO2 on a time scale, and they said, that does it.
But we see that second on the list of reasons to accept climate change was stewardship.
Nobody likes pollution. Nobody likes the idea of passing on a polluted planet to their kids. Stewardship is a great rallying point, and that came right through here. People realize that we don't want to mess up this one Earth that we have.
What about the weird weather we've been having? Did that affect people?
Right. So part of the problem climate change has when we teach it and talk about it is that it's far away. It's someone else's problem. It's, you know, I don't live in the Arctic. I don't care about sea ice. But right, when you feel it in your own neighborhood, when your ski area no longer gets snow, or when one poster bought snowshoes and then it like hardly ever snowed again after he bought snowshoes. And I think we have this lingering feeling in the back of our mind that we sort of think about climate change. You know, it's way back there somewhere. And then you have this weird, weird weather. And you go, oh, no, I guess that is what they were talking about. Maybe that is right after all.
Well, so you talked about why people were climate deniers in the first place, and it was usually family, close family, but also who they were listening to. And so you say one of the major reasons that they changed their mind is that they realize climate deniers' lack of credibility. The mouthpieces for climate change denial were wrong and that science was right. So do we conclude from this that we should just, what, go try to tell climate change deniers all about the science?
I think the approach needs to be quite personal. People would describe maybe a conversation with a trusted colleague or someone they looked up to or someone that just wasn't going to make them feel bad about it. And so you see this sort of a need for a little bit of a gentle treatment as they go through that process to just be nice about it.
That's Karen Kirk, freelance journalist, speaking to us about a question on Reddit that led to answers from former climate deniers about why they changed their minds. Karen, thank you.
Thanks so much. I'm really happy to have the opportunity to help foster good conversations, I hope.
Well, let's have another one. Let's bring in someone in the process, actually, of changing her mind on big issues. Becca Merrill, a doctoral student studying education policy at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. We met when we broadcast from WUNC in North Carolina, and she happened to talk to me about her evolving worldview. She was raised poor, conservative. Her family, members of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, they didn't believe in same-sex relationships. She says they embraced a lesser role for women and a view of America as a promised land. And then Becca went to college. Becca, what was that transition like?
It was a long one, maybe a decade. So it was something that I guess I kept on facing obstacles to being myself. When I left my family to go to school, I first got a degree at NC State in criminology, which made me look at crime differently for sure. And then I went back and I got a degree in religious studies. And this opened my eyes to patterns within religions that I had not seen before, worldwide patterns. And some of them seemed to be oppressive. And so when I saw that, it kind of planted more doubt in my heart, I guess. Then through the years, like as my faith evolved into something different than these other beliefs. So, well, if the Bible was possibly produced by people who had narratives that they wanted to teach the people with, but not necessarily narratives that came from God, then maybe God created everyone as they were supposed to be. Maybe there's nothing wrong with being gay, and we're just seeing it wrong. Or maybe it was just one person in history that decided that they didn't like this gay person and they created a narrative around it. Who knows? And so, like, there is so much less that we actually know about where religion came from. And so it opened up all of the beliefs that I've been taught for questioning.
Well, and that's kind of what we were talking about, this idea that everything you'd heard, it could be from a radio talk show host, it could be from a religion, but that maybe there's a different point of view. How unsettling is that? I mean, what's your relationship with your family?
Well, one of my sisters doesn't go to the church, and so she sighed relief because she now has someone else to talk to about her deepest issues in the family. And then I have another sister who's very active, and it was very difficult to talk to her about it and hurtful. My brother told me I was being prideful, as I predicted, but I haven't told my father. He would be sad, but he would never reject me. It's not a fear of that. It's more to save his feelings. But I'm going to talk to him. I have every intention of doing so.
Well, you sort of just started, Becca Merrill. But
he doesn't listen to NPR.
Oh, okay. Well, there you go. Well, but that's exactly what we're talking about, that people are in their own tunnels, in their own lanes sometimes. And it's when you first peek outside your lane, whether it's climate change denial or the denial of the acceptance of gays, whatever the lane is. Was it shocking for you to start seeing, wow, there's all these other people thinking other things?
I think that the shocks started coming more when I got into this PhD program and becoming aware that I had a worldview. You know, when you're raised in a bubble, you don't even realize that you have a worldview that could be different from others. I didn't realize I was conservative. I had no clue that I was any of these things. I didn't know I had a label. And so when I went into class, I thought that when I came to an academic setting that I could express my views and then more gently be taught about, you know, what research supports. And maybe I come across very confidently when I speak of my opinions, but in my head, I speak them so that it's like a starting point for conversation, not a place that I am sure of my knowledge. And that's been a huge change for me because growing up, I was taught that what I was being taught was the truth. And like truth with a capital T is how it was put to me. And so there is no other way of thinking. That's just, I've seen that, well, there are lots of ways to look at something. And sometimes I still can't come to a right answer on some things. I still don't know where I stand, like on something like abortion. I see both sides and I can't take one. And so like when I see that, I can't believe that there is one way of looking at it.
Well, you know, what you're saying, that even your confusion over it is rejecting something that your family used to believe, and yet confusion over it is a point of view. It's a valid point of view.
I don't see anything wrong with not having an answer anymore. Yeah. Yeah. I used to think I had to have answers to everything, but now, I mean, if there's a God, that will be great. I don't see a lot of evidence of it, but, you know, but I'm still open to the idea. It's not, you know, I don't disclaim other people's experiences. And so, again, just don't have an answer for it.
Becca Merrill, a doctoral student studying education policy at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, finding her own way in the world. Becca, thank you.
Thank you very much, Robin.
Today is International Workers' Day, May Day. So let's talk about workers. During the presidential campaign, President Trump cast himself as a champion of working class Americans. Here he is in New Hampshire on the eve of the election, rallying working class voters.
The corrupt special interests have stolen your jobs and shipped your wealth to other countries. They've betrayed the working class of this country. Tomorrow, the American working class will strike back. It's about time.
So how is President Trump doing on workers' issues now that he's in office? Celine McNicholas is labor counsel for the left-leaning Economic Policy Institute. They've just come out with a report about this. And Celine, lay out some of the ways in which you say the president has not helped or even hurt workers in America.
I think during the first 100 days, President Trump has taken a series of actions that really harm U.S. workers. You've seen the Congressional Review Act, which prior to this administration was only used successfully once, being used to repeal a number of worker protection regulations, including a rule that simply required companies with, you know, records of violating minimum wage and overtime laws and safety regulations to report that and have that factor into whether or not they would be able to be eligible for a federal contract. That's pretty basic worker protection stuff, and that is being blocked by this administration.
But a number of the regulations that you point out in your report that have been blocked by the administration hadn't gone into effect yet, correct?
That's correct. They had not yet taken effect. But that does not mean that those protections were not on the horizon for workers. In addition to the rules that have been blocked under Congressional Review Act, there are a number of regulations that have been delayed. And those are primarily in the worker protection space, the worker health and safety space. But it's likely that the Trump administration will take the time of the delay to institute a repeal of those rules as well. So simply because workers have not yet enjoyed those protections does not mean that they were any less important. And they would have been protections that they would have begun to enjoy in the workplace, but for the actions of the Trump administration.
And I imagine that if the Trump administration were asked about this and what you're saying right now, they would say, well, we're trying to get rid of onerous regulations that are stopping companies from hiring workers.
Sure. And I think it's a fair question to consider the cost of regulation. Federal agencies conduct extensive cost-benefit analyses when they're issuing a rule. And each year, the Office of Management and Budget reports to Congress on the costs and benefits of federal regulations. But those Office of Management and Budget reports have consistently found that federal regulations provide a net benefit of about $100 billion per year. But in my opinion, I think that looking at costs in that way fails to make a more basic point. Regulations are not so much about imposing costs. Costs exist either way. Regulations are really more about determining who pays those costs and when. And I think when you look at this, a rule like the Silica rule, which the Trump administration has delayed, you see, you know, workers who are exposed to silica dust, their families and those workers are paying costs now. The cost of health care, the cost of lost wages, the cost of dealing with a long-term illness. A regulation is really more about who pays that cost. Does the employer pay a preventative cost or does the worker absorb that cost?
Now, as we know, Trump's first pick for Labor Secretary, Andrew Puzder, had to withdraw his nomination after a lot of criticism about how he had dealt with workers in his career in corporate America. But now there is a new Secretary of Labor, Alexander Acosta. How do you think he'll be for working class Americans?
Yeah, I think it's very difficult to tell how Mr. Acosta will act as Secretary of Labor. He questioned whether or not the Department of Labor had the authority to take certain actions like setting a threshold for the overtime exemption. That's something that the Department of Labor has exercised for the history of the Fair Labor Standards Act. But in terms of the specifics of what an Acosta Department of Labor will look like, I think that it's very difficult to estimate that based on sort of the evasive nature of his responses to the HELP committee questions that he posed during that confirmation hearing.
Why do you think, if all of these things that you point out are so bad for the American worker, that you've got Trump holding a big rally, over the weekend in Pennsylvania with a lot of his supporters, and they're not up in arms about what's happening to workers, according to your report?
The president, has taken a great many actions, not, unique in the worker, rights space during his 100 days. And much of those actions have enjoyed real fanfare. I'm thinking of him driving the trailer right around the driveway of the White House. Those are moments where the administration has done a real PR effort. And I think what to me is uniquely troubling about, many of these worker protections that have been blocked or delayed is that those actions have been taken without that fanfare. President Trump may not be boasting about those actions, but they are clearly a priority in his agenda. They've taken place during these first 100 days. I think that in all of this noise and in sort of feeling like everyone is just sort of drinking from the fire hose, that actually provides an opportunity to do a great deal that can potentially be very harmful without necessarily having those public consequences.
That's Celine McNicholas, Labor Counsel for the Economic Policy Institute. We'll link you to their report at hereandnow.org. Celine, thank you.
Thank you.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.